Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
A science story, huh?
Is NYU scientist the...
I felt right.
I was so
and I just thought, well...
I figured it out.
It was that golden moment.
Because science was on my side.
Hey everyone, welcome to The Story Collider, where true personal stories about science help us to discover how weird and wonderful it is to exist in this world and be human. I'm your host, Misha Gajewski, and this week our stories are all about reality and perception and the doors of perception and how we never know if this is real life or just a fantasy. Stop me before I include any more classic rock references. Up first, Sean Musgraves. Sean knows a little about questioning reality. He's a lawyer, journalist, and lawyer who represents journalists. His work has appeared in Politico, The Verge, Vice, The Intercept, The Boston Globe, as well as the Netflix docuseries How to Fix a Drug Scandal. His story was recorded at Smitty's Bar in Washington, D.C. in April this year. In Sean's story, he can't figure out why it always feels like he's experiencing déjà vu. A true mystery worth investigating. Here's Sean.
So my whole life, I've been the smart kid. That was essentially my entire personality. In high school, I was obsessed with cramming for timed tests and my SAT scores, my AP scores. Ask any of my high school friends. I was so obnoxious. My greatest asset was my smart kid brain. Now, fast forward from high school to December 2012. This smart kid that stands before you has finished college and finally accepted that I'm queer and had been dating a guy named Santi for a few months. I switched majors constantly in college, and at the end, it came down to journalism or go to law school. I figure let's give journalism a shot, and then maybe we'll try law school in a few years. We'll see. And on this day, I'm doing my first serious interview for a serious story. I'm interviewing the deputy chief of police in Somerville, Massachusetts, which is just outside of Boston. I ask another question. We're almost done. And all of a sudden, this intense wave of deja vu just hits me. And my stomach sinks because I know what's about to happen. It's very, very hard to describe, but even like more than 10 years later, but it's like a dream or a movie starts playing on top of reality. I don't lose consciousness and I can still see this deputy chief of police that I'm interviewing, but I can't hear what he's saying in response to my question. And I actually can't speak for about 30 seconds. I just sit there. This has happened to me before, and it's actually happening to me pretty frequently at this point, but I have no idea what these spells are, how to make them stop. I actually think that they might be hallucinations, and so I am terrified to tell anybody, my family, my closest friends, my as-yet unofficial boyfriend named Santi. Whenever I feel the deja vu start, I usually just run and hide in the bathroom until the spell passes, but I can't always do that, like when I'm interviewing the deputy chief of police. So I just sit there nodding along. I can't hear what he's saying, but I nod along, and I wait for it to pass, and then I just quietly pack up my things and leave. Soon this is happening every single day, then multiple times a day, and finally, after way too long, I go see a neurologist, and he immediately diagnoses me with epilepsy. These are actually seizures that I've been having, and I'm relieved that they're not hallucinations, but I'm still really confused. These are called absence seizures, which are entirely cognitive. They don't have any muscular, like, convulsive component, and a lot of the times they start with what's called an aura of deja vu, just like what I've been having. Now, I have never heard any of this. This is pretty overwhelming. And then I tell Santi what's going on, and he immediately says, oh, those are absence seizures that you're having, right? He's a scientist. And these types of seizures often come from your temporal lobe of the brain, which plays a really big role in memory and language. And sure enough, I get an MRI, and there in my left temporal lobe is an abnormality of some kind. My first neurologist thinks that this is damage from a minor concussion that I got a few years ago. It's a totally separate story, but the smart kid the summer before college basically belly flopped off of a cliff into a small pool of water. Totally separate story, but I got a minor concussion, and so my first neurologist thinks that I had basically given myself epilepsy for the rest of my life by succumbing to peer pressure as a teenager, which was crushing, of course. Thankfully, the belly flop theory apparently was total bullshit and did not hold water for very long. Hold water. My second neurologist thought it was absurd. She looked at a new MRI and said, oh, this is actually what's called a cavernous malformation. It's basically leaky blood vessels in your brain that can cause seizures when they bleed a little bit. Small crumb of good news that I didn't actually give myself epilepsy. It was probably congenital. So I start on anti-seizure medication, and I hate it immediately. Anti-seizure medications work by basically slowing down your entire brain to prevent misfires. And so they turned this fast, smart kid brain into a drowsy, sluggish, like lethargic brain that was also a little bit cranky, Santi noticed. And so all of a sudden I needed to sleep tons more. I needed coffee to get going every morning, which was not the case before. And I actually had to really concentrate on thinking and speaking and reading. I hated it. And the drugs didn't actually always work. I would start a drug and have like this honeymoon period for a few weeks or a few months. And then the seizures would come back, including some really big convulsive seizures in my sleep, which were terrifying to both of us. And then surgery came up, actually taking out this part of my temporal lobe. And I said to, by now, my third neurologist, that kind of sounds like a lobotomy. I was joking. And he makes no eye contact with me and says, well, technically it is a lobotomy. And I asked that we stop talking about lobotomies again. But then I had to take more meds because the seizures came back. And so neurologist number four makes eye contact with me and brings up surgery again. Surgery could set me free from seizures and from the medication, but obviously there are a lot of potential risks from operating on your brain, like dying, and also maybe impairing your speech, impairing your memory, depending on what they need to take out of this part of your brain. And so I hold it together during that conversation, but I just fall apart outside the hospital. I'm terrified of what the surgery could do to me if it goes wrong. And then we finally find a combination of three different anti-seizure meds at pretty high dosages that keep my seizures under control. So we drop the surgery conversation. It's about 2018 by this point. I decide, sure, I'll go to law school. And we move across the country to California. And I still hate the seizure medication. I have to ask for extra time on the LSAT and exams, which would have mortified smart kid Sean. But for all 3 years of law school, I don't have a surgery, and I accept that this is just my steady state now. I'm drowsy, I'm grumpy, and I'm just a pain in the ass to get out of bed every day. This detente with my drowsy brain, though, ended last year after I passed the bar and was representing reporters now as my clients. I have been stable for a while, and so my neurologist refers me to an expert to just see how often should I be getting MRIs now. Turns out this expert is also a neurosurgeon, and he did not read my referral or chose to ignore it, because as soon as he sits down and looks through my scans, he says, I get why you're here. you're an excellent candidate for surgery. And I'm blindsided. We're here to talk about something totally boring, like how often should I stick my head in an MRI machine? And he wants to talk about cutting my head open. But he has this bizarre salesmanship. He has this little, he has this model of a brain that he keeps taking apart, like pointing to different parts. And so he says to me, listen, you're on a lot of meds. Do you like that? Do you want that for the rest of your life? Of course not. I hate my meds and they might not even always work. This just might be a particularly long honeymoon period. But what about risks? He says, he talks about the risks like they're nothing. It's like he's taking a bug out of ice cream. He's just like, this is such an easy surgery. Timing though. At this point, Santi and I were about to move back from California to the East Coast in just like a few weeks. So what about timing? He says to me, you will be back behind the wheel of a car a week after surgery. That sounded impossible. But he is selling this thing. He's selling me surgery so hard. And after 3 years of being on drugs, I despise and I can't even remember what it feels like to think without them. I'm sold. And I go home and I tell Santi, I think I want to have brain surgery like next month. And then we have some more level-headed conversations and decide not to sneak in a quick brain surgery before a cross-country move. But last month, on June 8th, I walk into New York Presbyterian and I go into the operating room and I lay down. At this point, I am so calm and so ready for this after that pitch and several rounds of like second opinions and tests. It turns out to be a 5-hour long operation, and I actually had to be awake for 45 minutes of it because before they were going to take out any tissue, they needed to confirm that they could take it out without impairing my verbal function or my memory. And so they would stimulate one part of my temporal lobe, which deactivates it, and then give me some quizzes. And it's incredibly foggy. My head was open. But I do remember one, which is, what is a mythical creature with wings that breathes fire? I got it right. And at one point, the neurologist and I just chat for a few minutes about how I got to New York. And then I'm pretty sure she held my hand as they put me under for the rest of the surgery. They ended up taking about a ping pong ball sized part of my temporal lobe out. And when the pathology results came out, it actually turned out, twist, not a cavernous malformation. It was actually a low-grade tumor. Specifically, it's called a PLENTY is the acronym, a polymorphous, low-grade, neuroepithelial tumor of the young. The young. And it was also like really calcified. It was like basically like a rock in my head. They were dazzled. They were. And so now we knew what's been in my head this entire time. Not belly flop scars or a cavernous malformation, a low-grade tumor of the young. It was great. The recovery also was incredibly easy. I was walking like a couple hours after surgery. They discharged me the next day. Within a few days, I actually dragged my mom to the Met just to get out of the apartment. And then, a week after surgery, I was approved to get behind the wheel of a car. Just like salesman surgeon foretold. It was unbelievable. It was so easy. Now, even a few weeks after surgery, we don't know if it worked, if my seizures are actually gone. I have to be on my meds for a few more months. And then after New Year's, I'll gradually ease off of them. And I got to choose which one we're getting rid of first. I know which one we're getting rid of first. That was so quick. And so far, it seems like it was the right call to cut out a ping pong from my temporal lobe to do a lobotomy, technically. Thanks.
That was Sean. To learn more about him, visit our website, storyclutter.org. Being a storyteller on our stage is just one way to make Storyclutter happen, but if standing alone, in the spotlight, in front of an audience, doesn't speak to you, maybe becoming a Storyclutter donor might be more your speed. Storyclutter donors play a vital role in our ability to bring you this podcast. We're in this together. Storyclutter is one big experiment that's designed to connect us around our love of discovery, curiosity, and the natural world. If you believe in the power these stories have and this mission, please donate to the Storyclutter at storyclutter.org/donate. The most popular level is $10 a month, and you can make your tax-deductible donation at storyclutter.org/donate. But really, any level makes a difference, and we're so grateful to everyone who supports Storyclutter. Our next story is from Shane Moss. Shane is a comedian and podcaster who's appeared on Conan, Kimmel, and Comedy Central. His story was recorded at our go-to spot in New York, Caveat, in April this year. And strap in, because Shane goes there. He is the guy who's going to give you a hilarious view of life inside his bipolar brain. Here's Shane.
I'm a very big fan of science. That's something I didn't see coming when I was a kid. I was raised in a small, wholesome Wisconsin town, had a very aw shucks kind of Pleasantville upbringing, and I didn't fit into it in any way. I never liked church, and I didn't like all of the rules. I didn't, didn't like authorities, that sort of thing. And great people, in fact, many of the people that I grew up around, they even went on to make America great again. But I didn't fit into it in any way. I just felt like blasphemy just to ask just basic questions about life, and it was very alienating for me. And that wasn't until I was 10 years old and I discovered stand-up comedy, and I fell in love with it. It was comedians could talk about all of the things that you weren't supposed to, and nothing was off limits, and stand-up comedy became my church. I was just obsessed. I knew I was going to become a stand-up comedian, as a teenager, I got into science a little bit because I never cared about school or anything. I didn't know how that was going to help my comedy goals, but I got into science as a teenager just to argue about religion with people. I basically learned physics and evolution just to be a dick for the most part. And then I went on, I became a full-time stand-up comedian, got to be on TV and all these things. And my love of science never left me. As I started touring, I started a podcast called Here We Are, and every city that I went to, I just looked up universities and random scientists to ask about life and how the mind works and everything. And learning about the mind, it changed my relationship with myself and how I understood life. And it even helped me get my mind back one time. And that's what this story is about. So it was early 2020. I was touring about four cities a week, and COVID shut everything down. And I lost just everything that I did. I stopped through my hometown to I'll visit my folks for a few weeks until things blow over, and got a hold of some past virologists and epidemiologists that I'd interviewed years before to ask them what was going on. And I was like, oh, I think I live with my parents for the next 2 years is what I'm finding out. And I lost all of my income. I lost the ability to pay a team of people that I had working with me. I lost a girlfriend at the time over the whole thing. It was awful. And I was soon after I lost my mind. I'm bipolar, manic depressive. If you don't know, that means I like to dream big and give up. And so when COVID happened, I went hypomanic right away. Hypomania is like a more mild form of a full-blown mania. Very exciting. You don't need as much sleep. A lot of good ideas. Like, oh, what if I turn toast into bread? A lot of weird inventions you're coming up with. And nothing too crazy. Very excited. It's a good state to be in if you're trying to rework your entire career when the rug's been pulled out from under you. But usually hypomania lasts for like a couple weeks. It's like an inspiring couple weeks, but this lasted for months, and it started leading to full-blown mania, which for me, it starts a lot of synchronicities happen and a lot of reading into things, putting together patterns that aren't really there, like reading secret messages and signs that only you can see, and you're getting special insights from the universe, and this is getting worse and worse, and it was May 2020, and now it's full-blown. I'm only sleeping like a couple hours a week of full-blown mania. I'm having psychosis, and I'm becoming more and more detached from reality. And then May 25th, 2020, I turned 40. That was my birthday. I turned 40 living in my parents' basement, and it was also the day that George Floyd was killed. And then a few days after that, in Minneapolis, very close to my hometown, the protests happened, fires, everything else, and something just snapped in my mind, and I just completely, it wasn't like I felt like it was a nightmare or something. It was, I completely lost sense of reality. I had no bearing on anything. I was convinced that nothing was real. I needed to tell everyone else in reality that nothing was real. They didn't seem to believe me. And so I came up with this idea that I needed to like confront all of my fears to convince myself that this wasn't real, and that I needed to like do crazier and crazier things to like snap out of a dream state. I thought I was dreaming. So there I am, naked, and confronting police officers, and I'm explaining to them that they aren't real, and they weren't taking me terribly seriously. And so I very calmly explained to them, guys, I've been a comedian for 20 years. I have dug deep to expose every skeleton in my closet and be as vulnerable as possible. It's generally effortless for me. This is what I would call a big share. I told the police officers that to convince them that they weren't real, that I was going to jump up their urethras like Ant-Man and then expand and make them explode. That's a real thing that I said while naked to police officers. Again, they didn't take me very seriously. And I don't know if I thought, it was like if Neo in The Matrix was a comedian that told too many dick jokes or something. I actually told this story on a podcast once, and someone wrote me, and I guess there is a scene like this in this comedy superhero series, The Boys. I've never seen that show, so great minds think alike, I guess. And so, anyhow, that was I was taken to a psych ward that night, believe it or not. And I went into the psych ward, and it was very scary. And I refused meds, and I was I just kind of took on as much curiosity as I could and tried to appreciate that I had an opportunity to be a bit of an anthropologist and get some insights that I wouldn't normally get. And I'm really into cognitive biases. I like neuroscience and psychology and how the mind works and evolutionary psychology and biology and stuff. And so, and psych ward's a great place to see it. So egocentrism is like a really clear cognitive bias. Cognitive bias is just like the predictable ways in which the human mind will often err. And so egocentrism, we're all born into this world thinking we're the center of our own universe. We tend to accidentally mistake that more things relate to us than they actually do, that sort of thing. We have evolved to overperceive patterns in things, because perceiving like a pattern and shape in the cloud didn't have a big cost to compared to like missing a useful pattern in life. We also tend to overperceive agency and minds in things, because that was so useful to evolve, and the cost involved of like talking to your plants or something like that, or you know, your old vehicle or appliance or computer takes on a personality when it gets a little wonky and has a mind of its own, that sort of thing. These are all normal things that we all have, but in a psych ward and under stress and under mental health issues, they're very amplified. So everyone in the psych ward was exceptionally talking to things that weren't there and working on grand puzzles and putting things together. Everything was about them, very self-referential. And I'm like, man, these people are so crazy. And then I remembered the objectivity illusion, which is that we tend to perceive ourselves as more objective and logical and rational than others. And then I realized that all of these mistakes they were making were the ones that I was making as well. And once I learned that, then I started noticing when my mind was making errors, and I was able to create a little bit of separation between having those thoughts and acting on them. And my mania just started dissipating without any meds or anything in just a few days. A few days later, the fear went away and the paranoia went away. And I was actually just like very comfortable being in a psych ward. If you want to know the trick to getting out of a psych ward, as soon as you're okay with being in a psych ward, they let you out of the psych ward. And it was a powerful experience for me. I always, as a kid, I wanted to be a big star and, you know, a big deal. And I suppose we all kind of do. After that, I just no longer really felt very attached to being like some big deal or anything like that. I'm quite happy to know that I'm not the center of the universe, actually, you know, a lot of pressure. And what great news for pee holes everywhere, too, because that kind of power goes straight to the heads, guys. So thank you guys very much.
Shane Moss, my friends, told you he was special. If you'd like to learn more about him, visit our website, storyclatter.org. Our website is just one way to connect with Story Clatter, but there are so many other ways, and we hope you'll use all of them. You can always follow us on social media. We're on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and TikTok. Head to storyclatter.org to become a financial supporter. Or if you want to come to one of our shows or want to start your own Story Clatter show in your community, you can learn all about that on our website, too. The Story Clatter is very grateful for the support of Science Sandbox, a Simons Foundation initiative dedicated to engaging everyone with the process of science. This podcast is produced by me, Misha Gajewski, along with Nikisha Roberts-Washington, Jen Chen, and Aaron Barker, Executive Director and Co-Founder of The Story Clatter. The stories featured in today's episode were produced by Shane Hanlon, Mariam Zaring-Halam, and Paula Croxon and Christine Gentry. Special thanks goes out to the Story Clatter's board and staff, including Anne-Marie Lonsdale, Leslie Brentson, and Lindsay Cooper. Our theme music is by Ghost, and next week, I'll be back with stories that explore what it's like to be an active participant in research. You won't want to miss it. Until next time, thanks so much for listening.